Hello and welcome once again for another episode of Profiles in American Funded Research. I'm excited to have my guest today, Hiroki Sayama. Hiroki got a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD, a doctorate in, at the University of Tokyo.
Yeah.
And there's been a ton of stuff that happened in between, but now he is the Executive Assistant Dean for Graduate Studies at Binghamton University. Is that correct?
Yes. Fairly recent change, but I'm partly an administrator, partly a faculty here.
Very nice. And I invited Hiroki on today to discuss a project that recently was completed. And I thought maybe I could just sort of hand over to you for the beginning, just like a brief overview of what the project was about. And then we can go from there.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeremy. So I just want to make sure that I get the right paper in mind. That was a paper we published earlier this year about the social networks and diversity, etc., right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. There are so many things going on, so I have to always remind myself what I'm supposed to talk about. Okay. So, yeah, thank you very much again, Jeremy, for having me on this. So this work is the collaboration with the school management here at Binghamton. It's a business school. And even though I'm a computer scientist by training, and as you know, we have been working a lot on more mathematical modeling of complex systems. And Jeremy and I collaborate together for several years on hosting conferences. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for hosting the last two editions of NERC's conference.
Yeah, I appreciate all the stuff that you do behind the scenes for those.
Yeah. So this year's version went very well just a couple of weeks ago here in Binghamton. But anyway, so despite that kind of mathematical computational background, this particular project was very much like an experimental study in social sciences. And we collaborated with the faculty members and the graduate students at the business school here to study the people's team performance. So we literally invited the graduate student to participate in a human subject experiment, and everything was online. So we set up some Twitter X-like simple platform where people can log in by using random login name and password, and they participated in some collaborative tasks. Very basic stuff, like coming up with a text-based design. Specifically, we requested things like, can you create a really nice slogan, a catchphrase to sell some product, like some mediocre laptop? There's absolutely no feature to focus, but can you come up with some crazy creative catchphrase to improve the sales? So this is really just a one-line task. You just come up with a cool line, and you can revise someone else's idea. It's a very easy collaborative task. But what we try to study was there are actually two things. One is a social network structure. What kind of network structure would be good? So should we connect people more, or should we keep them kind of separated? And these days, everybody is living on the interconnected world. There's some general consensus, quote unquote, that connections are always good, right? You should get networked, you should get connected, get more information, etc. Turns out our experimental results showed the opposite. So connections actually kill the ideas. So that's one, interesting findings that we discovered. The other aspects of the study was about diversity. It's a big topic nowadays, but not necessarily in the sense of political, ideological, diversity thing. And of course, diversity in the sense of gender, ethnicity, and race, culture, those are the very important topics. Sometimes we, discuss what kind of language we should or we should not use in today's funding climate. But I think in this particular study, we were not talking about those kind of political diversities. It's a more fundamental functional diversity. So even if we are both males, that we think differently. We know different things and we behave differently, maybe partly culture, but partly because of personalities. So aside from demographic, gender, cultural diversities, we have a much more fundamental diversities among ourselves. And I think that's more important, in my opinion, than just talking about pure superficial diversities, right? Sometimes people might call this as a deep level diversity, behavior diversity, functional diversity, but essentially we are different people, right? And especially for the, organizational management and operation, that kind of diversity is really why we want to hire a bunch of people, pay them, and then make them contribute to the project, because we want to have a different kinds of expertise, knowledge, and behaviors. So we tested every single participant's functional diversity by using machine learning. So we let them write down their fairly long self-introduction essay. So like what kind of measure they are studying, what's their interest, what kind of hobby they do, whatever else they want to talk about. And then projected their long essay into the metric space and then compared how similar they are, how different they are. And then we use that information to compose different kinds of social network structure during the experiment. And we discovered that the connection patterns between those different people actually influence the outcome of the team performance. Those are two major, experimental variables we tested, connectivity and diversity. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. So because this is kind of meant to be directed at a general audience, I thought we could back up a little bit and define a few things. And I'll let you do the definitions, of course. So when you're talking about a social network, what do you mean? What is a social network?
Yeah, so social network can be defined in many different ways, but you can just define very casually who you know, right? And who you hang out with. So in this particular experimental settings, we configured manually that who can see who else's ideas in the anonymous social network. So it's like a timeline. You log in, you see other people's ideas, and they are coming from your social neighbors. It's essentially the visibility, how far you can see from other people's posts. So it's kind of like a follower-followee relationships in Twitter, X, and the Blue Sky, that kind of thing. That's the more operationalized definition of social networks here. Yeah.
And then one other term that you put out there, which what is a metric space for people who don't?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So metric space is a mathematical term, but basically where you are located, if you do talk about a geographical map, your address is given in the longitude, latitude. It's a two-dimensional space. And the same thing can be applied to the wide variety of entities, like human ideas. So usually human ideas are considered to be written in the text, but there are mathematical and computational tools out there now. You can just plug in some natural language text, one paragraph or maybe one sentence into that kind of machine learning AI tools. Then it'll spit out a sequence of numbers. And that number could mean that your longitude is this, latitude is this, etc. And the dimension is much, much higher. So that's why you have a bunch of numbers, but essentially it's address of your idea in some space. So that's what I mean by metric space. But value is that once you get the address of your idea, and the address of my idea, we can measure the distance, like a Google map, how far they are, how close they are. And that actually gives us the measurement, the distance between different ideas. That's what we used in our experiment.
Thank you very much. So now actually I wanted to get to some of maybe the, perhaps one of the more surprising findings that you had, which was that you basically having more connections decreased ideas. Now, is this because perhaps people have a tendency to consensus? So you want to kind of shape your ideas to be similar to that group that you're connected to. So you do end up reducing the number of ideas.
Yeah, I believe so. That's the one measure, factor why the connectivity actually reduces the productivity of ideas. And because we tend to like, right? Liking the idea is easy. I agree. I like that. And then suddenly my mental space is occupied by that existing ideas. And then we're going to just start making minor changes here and there. So therefore, the idea diversity is lost because of the exposure to the other ideas created by someone else. So we are generally very agreeable animals, right? And sometimes people call this as a group think. You know, whoever spoke first in the meeting, that person's idea is going to dominate for the entire history of brainstorming.
So
even though we are supposed to explore many more, yeah.
So in some sense, it's better to have some people mixed in that are contrarians that kind of help drive.
yeah. There are, you know, definitely some kind of important roles those people are probably playing. The other factor I think is that if you are fully connected, your timeline is very busy, right? There are so many ideas coming out, and then you see many ideas, and you feel comfortable. Okay, so there are lots of discussion going on. Maybe I don't have to push myself too much. But if you are connected very sparsely, meaning that there are only a few people, you know, you can see, then your timeline looks very deserted. I need to push myself because nobody is putting idea. I have to produce. So that kind of, you know, pressure coming from the lack of ideas in your timeline might be another possibility.
That's interesting. Now actually kind of projecting onto my own life, I've noticed that there is like this balance, right, of how much should I read about a particular, how many papers should I read versus just going around and starting to play with ideas myself. Because if you you read too much, then you feel like there's nothing new to be done. So there's almost an advantage to not reading a whole bunch.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And then this is probably the really bad thing for me as a faculty to say, but I discourage students to read papers. Students love to read more papers, and then they always feel that, okay, they are not ready yet to do the research. They need to do more research. But, you know, in my opinion, if they come up with any idea, just do it. You know, write equation, write simulation code, etc. And it's perfectly fine for students to discover that their main result was already produced by someone else 30 years ago. That's great. You just reinvented the wheel. Yeah, so that's the great thing to do. So I think reading papers is definitely helpful, especially if you want to expand we are always doing the things on the shoulder of giants, right? But if you are always looking for a giant's shoulder, you are probably not seeing the far, far away that could not be seen, from there. But, you know, if you are just dropped down to the ground and then explore some other places, there might be a really hidden cave that giant did not notice. So, yeah, that's why I always prefer not reading papers before I test my ideas. I highly encourage graduate students to do the same. And I know I am a minority saying this. Yeah.
So How does diversity play a role here? So I know you kind of defined what you meant by diversity. I mean, people who think have very different ways of thinking and stuff. Does this help kind of guide the group away from, you know, is it really just even though there are diverse thinkers, you know, a lot of people still decide to drive towards consensus on ideas. How does that play a role here?
Yeah, so I think ultimately there is no absolute good or absolute bad with regard to diversity, because it's just the attributes of the people and attributes of the collective, and then it has effects. And yet, is it good or bad? It's really up to the objective of the entire collective or the objective individual, right? So we are very neutral in terms of the value assessment. So for example, if you want, you as the manager of the large team, and if you want to produce as many different ideas as possible coming from your team, then it's probably a better idea to not have diversity in the each subsection of teams. For example, if you have a team of 20, you divide it into, you know, five groups, you know, the group of four, for example, right? Four people working here, four people working there, and then you have five such different groups. If you want to expand the search ability of your team as much as possible, probably better to make each team homogenized. Maybe all white male here, all computer science engineers here, and then artists there, mathematician there. They work only with within their circle. So in that case, diversity is minimized in each subgroups, and this creates much more diverse exploration. As you know, mathematicians tend to go into the mathematically deep directions. Computer scientists go to the other directions. Artists have different arguments. So as a whole, the each subgroup, you know, diverges to many, many different locations. So the lack of diversity within each subcomponent actually creates a diversity as a collective. Or if you want to have a more conservative, safe, foolproof kind of design, you want to mix people's opinion from the beginning so that every subgroup has many, many different viewpoints represented equally so that they are not going to make any silly mistakes. So in that case, increasing diversity in the microscopic level will reduce the diversity at the collective level, but they're going to be more, very carefully vetted, tested ideas coming from that. So it's really how you're going to use that kind of heterogeneous nature. There's no, absolutely good way or absolutely bad way to use diversity. Yeah.
Now, was this network in your designed experiment, was it like a complete network, or were there subgroups that were, yeah.
So the fully connected network is actually used, yes. So complete network was one extreme. The other condition was not necessarily community-based. We actually used the localized ring network. It's like a, sorry, this is a technical term, but you understand, the small world network.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what Strogatz small world network without any random rewiring. So everybody is arranged in the ring-shaped locations, and then each person can see just nearest neighbor's opinion. So that is kind of the spatially clustered, but still connected network shape with very, very few number of connections.
Yeah, that one's obviously sparse relative to the complete network where everybody is talking to everybody.
Yeah. And one thing I forgot to mention, but it's very funny to say, is that people who participated in the fully connected network, they felt much better about the experimental session. We conducted a survey. How did you feel about this experiment? How confident you are. So people who participated in the fully networked version is always say, yeah, we did great. Our ideas are so good. And compared to that, people who participated in the very sparse network, they complained, there's really nobody here. It sucked. And yet performance was better for the second case. So there is a mismatch between our understanding of how we did versus how we were performing objectively. So this is a very interesting phenomena. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that speaks in some ways to the consensus part of we're very social creatures. So we feel better when we are associated with more people, but maybe that's not always the best for particular challenges to be happening.
And we might be all in the illusion that we are doing great, right? Yeah, we always get some social endorsement, reinforcement coming from social neighbors. If you're surrounded by a bunch of people saying the same thing, we are great, we are special, we feel good, and yet our actual performance may not be as good. So this is actually a very important insight. We can learn a lot of stuff from here. Yeah.
Now, so far we've discussed networks as if they're static, but in the real world, particularly social networks are not really static. Was there a dynamic component to this where, edges are changing and things over time?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. In this particular paper, we did not change that, but I have other papers about adaptive networks, which are the networks that change over time in response to what is happening in the state space, so to speak. Like people's opinions is one example, right? People form opinions based on what they hear from their neighbors. But their opinion difference might actually also influence the social network structure. Like your friend saying something crazy, so you're going to start unfriending him. Or maybe you want to follow someone whose celebrities, whose opinion agrees with yours. So that kind of co-evolution between social networks and opinion dynamics, that has a lot of implications on our social evolution. So we have studied that as well, yeah, in different papers.
Now, did you do some simulations as well in this work so that you could kind of validate, what are the important features over here by doing a simulation versus what actually happened in the...
Yeah. We do that all the time, yes. So the simulations are more like the much, much larger scale social evolution process, like hundreds of thousands of the agents working together. Experiment would be very difficult at that scale. But we compare the implications coming from the large-scale computer simulations and more small-scale human subject experiments. So generally speaking, they are in a good agreement. Yeah. Generally speaking, the locally clustered small world network-like structure, they tend to have the much more, they actually produce more, high quality results in general, even in the simulation. So, yeah.
And is that with the random rewiring? So you have a few edge?
Yeah.
Yep.
In that case, you can introduce random rewiring. I don't think that changes much, even in the experimental settings. Yeah. And also in the simulation, we can try to simulate the social evolution, which would be rather difficult to do in experimental settings. Like, what if people have a tendency to hate each other if the opinions are different? Depending on the simulation settings, society can get into the fragmented state. Many tiny social bubbles inside which the opinion is very homogenous and they are not really talking to each other. That happens all the time, right? So,
yeah, that's actually...
Again, I'm not saying this is good or bad. Again, this is a phenomena, yeah.
Let's take the argument that that was bad. If that was the case, how do you break out of that? What can you change about what features need to be changed to get out of those bubbles?
Okay. Yeah. Well, so I think there are many different intervention strategies we can take, both at the top-down way and the bottom-up way. So. Again, I'm not saying that this is bad, but I take your point. If that's bad, one solution we discovered was that if each individual knows the level of tolerance to the other different opinions is diversified. So like, I don't really care about the political ideology. I keep friendship with everybody. So that's a very high tolerance person versus the, some other people might be low tolerance. I never, like zero tolerance people, they never, connect to others, whose opinions are different. So if the society as a collective has a wide variety of tolerance levels, we can actually create a still connected society, even though they maintain many different diverse ideas. So this is one of the simulations we did a couple of years ago, which is very interesting because usually when we talk about tolerance, we always say this is the good way of tolerance. So you always recommend one particular level. Could be zero tolerance or you should be tolerating, either way, one way or another. But our simulation models show that the tolerance level can be very diverse. So this is yet another behavior diversity in our society. Yeah.
Now,
and again, we should interpret this in a more value-neutral way.
Yes.
It can be the opinion variation, but it can be language, for example, right? We don't want to lose the linguistic diversity or maybe cultural diversity, religious diversity. Having the social bubbles can mean there is a group of people who are speaking their own language, maintain their own culture. But if the society gets globalized, so that we are actually probably losing a lot of important diverse things. So depending on the context, we should promote more of the fragmentation to some extent. Yeah.
But it's important to know how you can kind of switch between those two as well.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yes.
Now, with a simulation, obviously, you can kind of, I'm not going to say it's limitless, but because obviously there are computational limitations, but you can make networks pretty large, right, in the simulational setting. But how big was the network in this study for the experimental side?
So can you elaborate more on your question? I didn't get
that. So how many nodes, how many people were involved?
Yeah, experimental setting is fairly small, like maybe 22 to 25 people. So it's not really a network. It's more like a group, right? So, but 22, 23, 24, 25, that level is good enough to manipulate the connectivities. And we also manipulated the who's going to be sitting next to whom. So when you are creating a ring-shaped network, you can actually change the physical spatial arrangement. So one condition is that, everybody is sitting next to others who are very similar to them by minimizing the background distance across edges. Another condition is to maximize it so that everybody is sitting next to someone who is totally different from them. So that kind of manipulation start to make sense at that level of network. 20 people, you can actually control that kind of social connectivity based on the background diversity. Yeah. And of course, we want to do a much larger scale, experiment, but that...
It gets harder to control when it's bigger.
Yeah, 100 people, it's kind of hard to control. And also, practical implication might become a little bit unclear because very few people manage the team of hundreds, right? Team size is typically like 10 to 20. So we decided that would be a reasonable size. Yeah.
That's fair. Now, how did you measure, what things did you measure about the people? Because you mentioned this diversity in ideas and whatnot. So what were the features there? What were you measuring about the people to kind of see what that diversity was?
Yeah, so this was actually one of the biggest points of the reviewers' criticisms. The only thing we did was just ask them to write a fairly long essay about themselves. It was a free form survey. So please write about yourself, including your academic major, background, interest, career plan, hobby, family, if they want. But it was entirely open-ended written document, and then we put that into the machine learning. So therefore, we did not specifically mention...
Yeah.
So we just used the AI machine learning, like a DocTuVec is the specific algorithm we used. That was back in the... we started this experiment in 2017 or 18, so before the ChatGPT. But we were using the fairly well-established semantic embedding algorithm that was already available back then. So then each essay was mapped to the, I think, 400-dimensional metric space. But we didn't really specify which features should be described. It was completely open-ended.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you got a pushback on that, because that sounds like sort of the best way in my view.
I agree. So, but people have different opinions. Like a social scientist, many reviewers said, why did you not actually ask race, ethnicity, gender explicitly? Because that was always kind of important factors in their opinion, which I disagree. But yeah, yeah. Reviewers are different kind of people. And we are facing the diversity of ideas already here, right?
Yes.
I believe this way, they believe that way. Yeah.
And so it mapped to some kind of 400-dimensional space. So now you have this big vector of components that you're matching these people by. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And we did some validation, of course, because 400-dimensional vector can mean nothing, right?
Right.
So we actually tested some sanity check by having the human evaluator. One of them that turns out to be me and the grad student. We did the select randomly, like this is the one essay, this is another essay, this is yet another essay, three of them. Which two of them is closer than the others? So we tested that kind of self-evaluation. And then two evaluators did almost exact agreement. So that means the humans can evaluate which one is closer than others. And the machine learning algorithm result is also showing the fairly good correlation with what people would consider. These two people are closer than others. So it's not totally crazy. So we tested that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's like the golden standard when you're dealing with these kinds of social things, because just social networks in general, or social interactions in general, are just so hard to it's not like a physics problem, right, where you can kind of break it down into small components and you figure out this is the dynamics of this, or whatever. It's much more difficult in a social setting. But the fact that you were getting good agreement with both the humans and the machine learning method is a good validation, I would say.
Yeah. But I think that the physics model has some implication also. Like if you are talking about the very high dimensional things, like a 400 dimensional vector as a background, it's a very high dimensional thing. Eventually, it might be very much similar to the oscillator model in physics, right? So it's a different phase, or the in sync or out of sync. It's a one parameter model, but ultimately we might be talking about something very similar.
Yeah. Right. No, I understand. Of course, in physics, the interactions themselves can get very complicated. I understand that, of course. But yeah. I meant it's not like you can just break it down into a small component, look at only that component, and kind of pull apart the details in the same way that you can in physics.
Yeah. You have the physics background, right?
What's that? I do have a physics background. Yes.
So you can definitely contribute to the social science, and vice versa.
I think of myself as pretty interdisciplinary. I was actually trained by an applied mathematician. My PhD is in physics, but my advisor was an applied mathematician. I work with computer scientists, so I get quite a bit of background with a bunch of different ideas.
That's the value. So we have the low tolerance. we accept all kinds of terminologies and methodologies academically.
Yes.
So we act as kind of the bridge between different disciplines, right?
Yes. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. And I think it's an important role. I mean, I think there's obviously also an important role for the ones that are, like pure mathematicians, of course, or whatever, but I think the interdisciplinary among us are also help push science forward.
Although we always have a hard time getting funding, because interdisciplinary research is extremely difficult to get funded.
You're not doing math, so you shouldn't apply here, and you're not doing this because yes.
Yeah. Many of the comments we received that, well, you are not one of us, that kind of comment, ultimately. Social labeling is the in action in science as well. Sadly.
Now, because a component of this is, telling people what their money is going towards, What kinds of things are the research grants that you get spent on? Is it labor? Is it getting, in this case, getting participants involved? Did you offer some kind of monetary incentive? Those kinds of things. What was the money for?
Yeah, we didn't really pay anything to the participants. It's a fairly large scale experiment. We get more than 600 people participating, so we didn't pay them, but instead we just gave them tiny bit of extra credit for coursework. So the most of the money was spent for the graduate students. That's it.
Yeah, the salary.
And you know, the salary of the grad student. Science is really about hiring grad students because they do the work. They attend all the sessions. They did the analysis. They wrote papers. So and that's pretty much it. And when it comes to the social science or theoretical studies, it's really graduate students. We didn't even hire postdocs. We didn't have any postdocs. It was done by ourselves and the grad students. And of course, we get a little bit of a summer stipend as a faculty, but because the budget was cut, that was not the recent one. It's several years ago, but the budget is always negotiated by NSF. And yes, then we have to minimize our summer salary, maximize the money allocated to grad students. That's pretty much it.
That's true, by the way, outside of the NSF too. Military funding, true. Whatever. They're always trying to negotiate things down.
And to the taxpayers listening to this, you know, graduate student salary is extremely low. So we are not paying a lot to them. They are absolute minimum, and yet they work very hard for the progress of science. Please.
Depending on the minimum wage and where you are, these grad students aren't making much more than minimum wage. I mean, like.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So we absolutely, you know, to appreciate their dedication, devotion for the science. Yeah. Without grad students, we can't make any progress.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now one thing that I always like to leave off on at the end is I really, because of my own personal interest, I really like to hear the stories of how you got involved in science yourself. You know, if you could back up maybe back to high school or earlier or whatever, what got you interested in science and sort of set you on this path?
Yeah. So I don't know what kind of story going to be most appealing, but quite honestly, I never imagined I'm going to become a professor or a scientist to begin with. My dream career was to become a video game developer. Seriously. Yeah, like middle school, high school, I was among the early generation to having the personal computer for to begin with, like 8-bit computers. I was building all the video games, bringing those things to the local video game companies. That was still the very budding stage. So, you know, I grew up in Japan, so I was not really using any PC or standardized platform. It's a local one. And then when I went to college, I, of course, chose the computer science because that would be a skill needed to become a video game developer. And during the college time, I discovered something that is very critical. I was not good at the video game playing. So I did not really, So I did not really, get engaged in the actual aesthetic design of human, user interface. Those are all critical aspects when you are designing video game. And then I was terrible at playing and designing. And then I did a little bit of soul seeking. What was I interested in? And after doing a little bit of soul searching, I discovered that what I was interested in was actually creating the mechanistic thing that is behaving as I code the rules. That was a virtual world that I was playing, building, but it does not have to be a video game because I was terrible in satisfying the player. Instead, I was satisfying myself by creating those virtual worlds. And that's the whole reason why I became a complex system scientist, right? That we do the same thing. We build a model and we put the rules and then the computer actually simulates the results so that we can see how this, the virtual sandbox is going to develop itself. That was fascination for me. So the rest is the history. But I really want to become a video game developer. Luckily, one of my sons became a video game developer. So that was achieved in the next generation. So good for him.
There you go. But
I
would argue, though, that being a video game developer does require very similar skills, even though you're...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the most of the modeling the materials that I teach in these days, it is something that I acquired when I was a high school kid. So thinking about algorithms, like you know, behavior. Like, here's a parabolic movement of object. How do you simulate it? Well, it's a computer game, right? Super Mario jumping. Yeah. You need to think about the force and acceleration, etc. So everything I did back in high school, middle school, it's helping me now. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me. I was glad when you accepted to come on. So I thought this was a great episode. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure. Thank you.